Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our communities on the Central Coast. Voices addresses how today's choices may affect tomorrow's community, how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society and how they affect us both locally and nationally and internationally. We're going to talk today about immigrants in crisis and really the whole immigration issue, which I have to observe, no matter how much detail you get into and look at things, it's really hard to know exactly where we are and how things will work. We're continuing to change the immigration policy under the Trump administration, and it includes denying asylum claims, heightening enforcement efforts in the U.S. with ICE and other organizations, and shedding out skilled workers and restricting family-based immigration issues. Having immigrant families and children abroad and then looking at how they fit into your ability to as an immigrant, to really assimilate in the United States. We really are on the Central Coast. We hear from a lot of folks that are heightened by a state of a heightened state of fear, if you will, and anxiety over what's going on in the immigration world. There was a bill passed in the California legislature called SB 54, known as the Trust Act, and it was signed into law in 2017, and there's been a couple of modifications, I believe, to it since then. We're really going to talk about how that and the general stand of the government in California and citizenry in California looks at the about 2.3 million immigrants who live illegally in California. My guests today are Abraham Melendrez. He is the Santa Maria organizer for CAUSE. That's the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy. And Anahi Mendoza, who is the executive director of the Santa Barbara County Immigration Legal Defense Center. We want to discuss how the ongoing crisis affects not only our borders, but affects people who already live here, how it affects local immigrants, legal and illegal in some cases, and how the choices those individuals have to make or might have to make affect our community. Want to remind you that this is a call-in program. We would welcome you to be part of the discussion. I would encourage you to call in as early as you can if you want to be part of this discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Abraham, I am going to start with one question to you, only because I think it may be unclear to a lot of people. Anahi's organization by title is really clear as to what it is, but what is CAUSE and how does CAUSE as an organization play into work within the immigration issue?
Yes, so first of all, thank you for having me. So CAUSE is Central Coast Alliance for United for a Sustainable Economy. We mostly have worked in Ventura and in Santa Barbara counties for the past 16 years now, almost 17. And a lot of what we do is we're the biggest organization in the Central Coast that's around activism and fighting for people's rights. So when it comes to farm worker issues, when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to housing issues, and then one of our big ones, of course, has always been immigration issues. And that's one of the things that we do, whether it's at the state level on policy work or even just at the local level by organizing community members to basically fight for people's rights here in the Central Coast.
Thank you, because as an organization name, it's sometimes hard to pin to that organization what they're
yeah.
doing.
So we are a multi-issue organization, but immigration is one of our big pillars.
Okay, Anahi, are you still there? You're not in the studio, so I can't see you, but I wanted to make sure you're on the line with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Okay, can you give us some background? I guess, why is there an Immigration Legal Defense Center in Santa Barbara, and how does that fit into the issues overall?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center became operational in March of 2018, and we came out of a coalition of organizations, including CAUSE, the Fund for Santa Barbara, Legal Aid, Importa, Immigrant Hope, legal service providers that noted that while they were providing legal services to their constituents or clients, many of them were immigrants, and they had some type of immigration case. Now, when we think about immigrant rights, we mainly see the courts that we have are the LA Immigration Court and the San Francisco Immigration Court. Those are the two courts that we have in California. And we've got some great nonprofits in LA, some great nonprofits in San Francisco. We don't have any nonprofits that are exclusively working on deportation defense on the Central Coast. So since, to just give you some numbers, from November of 2017 to May of 2018, ICE has made 2,892 arrests in Santa Barbara County and has placed these individuals in deportation proceedings. Many of these individuals are unable to afford an attorney and rely on nonprofits or nonprofit organizations to prepare their defense. In Santa Barbara County and in all of the Central Coast, actually, Santa Barbara County, Ventura County, San Luis Obispo County, we didn't have an organization that would provide free deportation defense. And so that's how the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center came to be. And we are working on training pro bono attorneys to represent people who are placed in deportation proceedings and educating the community on their rights.
For clarification, those 2,892 people you're talking about, who are, as far as the federal government's concerned, they're being processed to be deported regardless of where they came from. Once they are arrested, where do they end up while this procedure is going on? Are they in jail? Are they in a federal detention facility? Are they given any kind of bail or ability to be on their own recognizance?
It depends case by case, but usually what happens is an individual is arrested, maybe at their home or coming out of county jail, which we see very often. They're sent to a processing center. We have two processing centers on the Central Coast, one in Santa Maria and one in Camarillo. These are ICE processing centers where people are held for a few hours. They're held there until they're transported to an immigrant detention center. Folks in Santa Barbara County are usually sent to the Adelanto Detention Center, a facility run by a private prison company called the GEO Company. It's in the high desert and in a very remote area of San Bernardino. People are held there while they await their hearing with the immigration judge. Alternatively, they may be sent to two other facilities, the Theo Lacy Detention Center or the James Music Detention Center, both in Orange County and run by the Orange County Sheriff's Department. And so individuals are held there until they see a judge. And because of the remote locations, there aren't very many attorneys that want to go to the high desert. So there's very little access to representation for many of these individuals.
When this kind of detention takes place, that's to some extent putting the person who's detained far away from any kind of family or support system. And as you were making that comment, it occurred to me that if I were the spouse of someone who was at that detention center in the high desert, and I was also either illegal or was concerned about whether or not my status was valid as we look at things, I'm assuming that going out to visit my family member might put me at risk.
That's correct. These detention centers obviously house ICE officials, and so it's not recommended that undocumented individuals go and visit their family. Only individuals who are either residents without a criminal record or U.S. citizens do we recommend that they go visit their family members. And so a lot of the communication that's done with individuals that are held there is through attorneys who are able to visit these individuals in facilities. And you bring up a separate point that the impact of someone being detained is huge for the family. Usually the individual that's detained in Santa Barbara County is male and the primary breadwinner for the family. And what that means is that when they are detained, the mother and the children are left to pay the rent, are left to drive the kids to school, are left to provide for the family, and after not having a job, because that was the role of the primary breadwinner, they're left to get a job and try to see how they'll raise their children without that individual, in addition to trying to find representation for their family member. Because while in the criminal court system, we have the public defender's office, in the immigration court system, we don't. Individuals have the right to find an attorney, but they don't have the right to obtain an attorney at the government's expense. And so the cost of having someone represent you can range anywhere between maybe $1,500 to $20,000, depending on your immigration case.
If you have no resources as a detainee, and for whatever reason organizations like yours may not be available for everybody, what happens to that person as far as the ability to represent themselves?
Well, immigration law is very complicated. Individuals are sometimes given, the process looks like you begin with a master calendar hearing, where you appear before the judge and take something like pleadings. If you don't show up with an attorney, you're often given another hearing, but by that hearing, you have to have an attorney. And if you don't, the judge will have you represent yourself. And like I said, immigration law is really complicated, so when you do represent yourself, it often means that you kind of self-incriminate, as if we were to use criminal court terms. And if you say, hey, maybe I'm eligible for this form of relief, asylum, cancellation of removal, et cetera, you're left to prepare your entire case while detained. Now, while you're detained, you don't have access to witnesses. You don't have access to collecting evidence from your home country. You don't have access to country conditions reports, et cetera, et cetera. So usually what happens is that people are detained, their final merits hearing is set, and they're usually ordered deported.
Okay. One of the key factors that that prompted us to do this program right now is the what SB 54 is, or the Trust Act, and how that's seen by the federal government, because it doesn't take a whole lot of time looking at media to realize that the federal government and the government of the state of California are at loggerheads in this regard to some extent. I throw this out to either of you, if you can explain what SB 54 is and how we've enamored ourselves to the federal government.
Yeah, so I can speak a little bit on that. There's actually three laws that are, so SB 54 is not the Trust Act. That's a different a law. So the initial law was the Trust Act, which kind of gave rights to immigrants to have, it covers a lot of things, but one of them being that while they're detained, they would have to sign something if immigration agents wanted to interview them. They would be given access to an attorney to speak to speak with them alongside with that, and they provided some kind of some protections. Then the Truth Act came about, and that is really to create transparency over how the sheriffs and local police agencies are working with ICE. So they will have to release information about the amount of requests they would be getting and how they were cooperating with ICE. And then the most recent one, which SB 54, which is the California Values Act, that's the most recent one that just got signed. That one creates even more barriers for county and for local police officers and agencies to work alongside with immigration. Things such as not being able to hold people specifically for immigration reasons. Obviously, this only pertains to immigration and not to an actual criminal act. That's separate. Mm-hmm. And so those three kind of laws together have created kind of like the structure now, which we've seen the trend that California has been standing with immigrants. And so our state lawmakers have done these laws to kind of separate. And there's a lot of reasons why we want to separate sheriff and local police agencies from immigration. Many of them, including one of them, is the fact that we want immigrants to be able to trust local police, to be able to, if there's, for example, a victim of, domestic abuse or something like that, we want to be able to have them trust that they can call, help without being afraid that they would get deported. And there's a ton of other reasons why, but those are kind of like some of the basics.
That's a very good point, because one of the things that I've read the most about in the media is, not just in California, but in other places, is that issues of domestic violence don't get reported often by immigrants if they're not here legally because they are literally afraid they'll solve one problem, create a bigger problem for their family. And I think that comes up all the time. Do you only end up dealing usually with people who have already been detained, or do you work with people who are in fear of being detained?
We do both. So we work with people who are held in immigrant detention centers and are from Santa Barbara County or the Central Coast. We pair them with a pro bono attorney who will represent them on their bond case. That's one group of people we work with. The second group is people who are already in deportation proceedings but have been released on an ankle monitor or are under an order of supervision. And we help them either by referring them to a nonprofit in LA or San Francisco or by pairing them with a pro bono attorney to represent them on their case. The third group of people we work with is people who want to understand a little bit more about their rights. And so in January, we'll be launching our community education program, which will consist of immigration promotoras, Spanish and Mixteco speaking, who will be going out into the community and educating the larger public on what type of criminal offenses could result in an immigration consequence, and what they can do to protect themselves from being detained and deported in on the Central Coast.
Okay. I tried to figure out how to ask this question, so I'm going to probably just ask it as maybe more directly than you like. But you at one point in your life, probably sometime by the time you were about 4 or 5 years old, were technically in this country illegally. Are you willing to talk about the process and experience of your basic childhood and early years? I mean, among other things, you at one point, I understand, you received a full scholarship to UC Berkeley, but you couldn't accept it because you had to be a bona fide legal resident in order to attend UC Berkeley, I guess, or to get the scholarship. So you've had some firsthand experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I came to the U.S. when I was 4 years old with my family. We settled into Santa Barbara, California, and that's where I grew up. Later in high school, we moved to Santa Maria, which I was not too fond of, but now came to love, and this is where I live and work. When I was in high school, I worked really hard. I knew that I was undocumented, and I wanted to make sure that I had access to an education, which is something my parents always stressed. My dream school was UC Berkeley. You're right. I applied. I was admitted. And I was offered a Chancellor Scholarship, which would allow me to basically get everything paid for. But when it came time to obtain the money from the scholarship, I was told that I couldn't because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. And so this was really a big setback for me because I'd been working really hard for this. I graduated valedictorian from my high school and thought that, you know, I could go anywhere to college. Fortunately, I had also applied to a private school on the East Coast, and I was admitted. And this is, you know, it's not very well known, but a lot of the Ivy League universities, in particular Harvard, provide full need-based financial aid. So if your parents make less than $80,000, they have enough private money to give you a full ride. And so I got a full ride that way. And I remain a DACA recipient. I have not received residency or U.S. citizenship. Often people think that you can get in the back of a line, or you can, you know, work hard enough and you can obtain your residency or your citizenship. That's not how U.S. immigration law works, unless you have someone to sponsor you, unless you've been a victim of a crime, unless you get married, you aren't particularly eligible to work for your residency or your citizenship.
So you currently fall under what we know of as DACA?
That's correct.
Okay. Candid question. The lack of support at the national level for the continuation of the DACA program puts people like you in rather risky territory. How do you address that on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, things with DACA are constantly changing. It's threatened. Then we get a decision from one court. We get another decision from another court. Now it's looking like maybe the Supreme Court. I think for the common public, it's very anxiety provoking. There are a lot of young people in this country who have been working really hard and have received an open door, basically, to pursue their dreams. Many of my friends are in medical school and are able to actually work at hospitals because they have DACA. Many of them have become attorneys, et cetera, et cetera. And even beyond those who are, you know, the quote-unquote good immigrants, there's all types of DACA recipients. The most common DACA recipients, you know, have a job and maybe work in retail or something of that matter. And so I think the constant threat at the federal government has produced a lot of anxiety for all of us, and that we live in this type of legal limbo. We don't know what will happen the next day. I don't think it necessarily means that we live with fear every day. That's something that a lot of people like to hear our quote-unquote sob stories. I don't think that it's that, but there's definitely that anxiety of we don't know if we'll be able to remain in the U.S., one, and have a work permit.
Individuals like you are not doing a good job of staying under the radar. I mean, and I'm not suggesting that you should stay under the radar. I think it's just, it's remarkable for me to see the number of individuals who, for lack of a better way of putting it, the very nature of what they do for a living or for a cause are drawing a lot of attention to themselves. I mean, I'm wondering whether or not individuals like you end up at the top of the list of what the federal government through ISIS would prefer to have happen, because you're not a quiet individual.
I guess that's a good way to say it. That's correct. There are a lot of us that are very involved. I'll admit that when I was working at the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas, I was working inside a detention center, so I was working with asylum seekers who had just arrived and were detained at the South Texas Family Residential Center, mothers and their children. This is before anyone really knew that mothers and children were detained. Every day I would email ICE, every day I'd call ICE, and I'd ask them for documents for our clients, et cetera, et cetera. And my parents were really stunned by this. They didn't like it. They said, how could you, you know, you have DACA, how can you be in there talking to ICE? And to this day, I still talk to ICE because it's the nature of my work. I think it does put a public eye on us, and it could be good and it could be bad. There was one immigration activist in New York that was detained by ICE because of a lot of his advocacy. And so those cases are happening. But I think it's important for those of us that want to and that can to step forward and talk about how we are just like everyone else, whether we have documents or not, and we need to stay out in the public light to remind everyone that they need to come out to the streets and they need to come and fight for our rights and their rights. And I think that that's what we're really asking for with people to come to our public forum that's taking place on December 4th here in Santa Maria. Another one is taking place in San Luis Obispo, and another in Ventura County. We want to hold agencies like ICE accountable, and we want to hold our local and state law enforcement accountable for what they're doing and their relationship with ICE. So I think it's something that can be used in a positive way.
Yeah. I want to remind folks that if they want to be part of this discussion, you can call in and be part of this discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We're talking today about issues of immigration and how they affect residents of the Central Coast and residents of California versus some of the things going on at the federal level. Abraham, mm-hmm. The number of of people that you see on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Most of your day is not spent with the legal issues like Anahi has. So what are you dealing with mostly on a daily basis?
Yeah, so on a daily basis, we're really focusing on fighting for policy things. So we were a big advocate of fighting for SB 54, and in the past, you know, for the Truth and the Trust Act. And some of the other stuff that we do locally is we organize communities to hold their local government accountable. So Anahi mentioned that there's actually a Truth Act forum that's happening. And this is something that every county in all of California has to do starting this year, I believe, is that they have to at least once a year hold a public forum where they have to give information about how our sheriff's offices have been cooperating with ICE. And so Santa Barbara will be having theirs on December 4th at 3 p.m., and they'll be having it in Santa Maria as well as voice or video in from Santa Barbara. Ventura will also be having it at the same time, Ventura County at 3:30 actually. And then Slo County will be having it at 9 a.m., all of them on the same day, December 4th. And so our job really is to make sure the community is informed and educated, and that they show up to make sure that we are holding our local government accountable. You know, we have a lot of folks who always, you know, reach out to us and are mortified by what's happening in the border, whether it's children being locked up or families being tear gassed. And I think when we're seeing what's happening with immigrants at the border, we sometimes forget that some of those things are, you know, families are still being separated here. Families that are our neighbors, that are, you know, children's schoolmates, that are our own coworkers. And so I think for people that have been mortified hearing what's happening at the federal level, this is a great opportunity for you to get in action locally and to make sure that our county knows that our sheriffs and the local police should not be working with ICE, because legally the sheriff's office is not mandated to cooperate with them. But some counties and some sheriffs do decide to willingly cooperate with them. And so that's something that we want to make sure we work on at the local level.
Yeah, in not all states are this way, but in most states it is. Most county sheriffs are elected officials. So yes, they have the board of supervisors in any county cannot fire the sheriff.
That's correct. Okay,
so that person is not an employee of the government agency. They're basically a directly voted in position. Does that tend to reflect a more conservative bent of sheriffs, and I don't know. I'm just curious as to whether or not that's a positive factor for the best advocacy for immigrants, or if that's a negative factor.
Well, I think that the county still has some responsibilities, whether it's budgetary. They can also set precedents for some policies on how some of the jails are operated. So that's kind of how we've been approaching it. I do agree that obviously they can't fire the sheriff, and that's an elected official. But what we're doing is really focusing at all levels. And so we do it whether before SB 54 passed, you saw communities that were trying to pass sanctuary cities, right? So that's some of the things that we worked on. Similarly at the county level, and then we are part of a bigger coalition as well, statewide, to continue to pass these statewide, acts or legislation.
Yeah, I pose this question to both of you. Do you get calls and emails and contacts through both of your organizations from people who are, I guess, beyond resentful for what you do, but flat out feel like what you do is, can't think of a better word, un-American in their eyes? And how do you respond to those people?
So I think I can start in. We have had encounters, obviously, with people who are not happy with what we're doing. The way that I like to put it is that we are doing, if anything, I am a citizen myself, actually. I'm lucky to be a citizen. Mm-hmm. And for me, nothing is more American than to fight for people's rights. And so when we talk about holding the sheriffs accountable, we're talking about, this is laws. This is the law of California. And we just want to make sure that they're following the law, too. And so for me particularly, there's nothing more American than to making sure that all these people have rights. Similarly, at the federal level, a lot of these folks are seeking asylum. So that's a law that we should be allowing people to come in seeking asylum. You know, even if we go into international, you know, Geneva Convention, a lot of those things, you know, they mentioned that, you know, there are those kind of things in place. And so for us, it's really just about making sure that those things are being followed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Anai has more to add.
Anai?
I get a lot of those questions on the radio. people who think that maybe it's un-American to support quote-unquote criminals or people who aren't here with documents. I think that what many organizations are fighting for is humanity. At the end of the day, the people that we work with are humans, and that's something that we all need to remember. The Immigrant Legal Defense Center in particular, we're fighting for due process. It's one of our core beliefs and values and ideals in the United States to make sure that everyone has a proper day in court, to make sure that people are given the opportunity for redemption, to help survivors, to help people because they are humans just like us. And so I think that it's more American to be fighting for people's rights. and so that's what I often say to people.
The current administration in Washington has done a lot to try and imply that there's a disproportionate number of illegal residents of the United States that are beyond their illegal status are criminals. I've fact checked that on three different directions and found that that's not the case. But I suspect that's still something you hear often, and both of you.
Yeah, and actually going back a little bit to the previous questions, a lot of the folks that are upset about the work that we do are kind of folks that are falling victim to the rhetoric, right? The Trump rhetoric of immigrants being criminals. But I would say that, you know, as you've seen by your fact checking, that that's actually not the case. And I think that's something that we're worried about. We want to make sure that people understand that you know, immigrant families, like I said, are our neighbors, are, you know, our coworkers, just like you and me. And so that we can't be falling into that kind of rhetoric, because then, you know, that's why they use to criminalize our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just add to that the undocumented population from 1990 until 2013 has more than tripled. But FBI data shows that the violent crime rate has declined by 48% over the same period. And so there's always this conflation between immigration and crime that's just not factually correct. And what usually happens and what, you know, what we've heard from the Santa Barbara County Sheriff is that there are these individuals that are causing, you know, terror in the community, and that were maybe released from the Santa Barbara County Jail and then fled. That is usually a limited number of people used to scapegoat entire communities. The vast majority of individuals that are part of the immigrant community are out there committing crimes. And those people that are should be given the opportunity for redemption. And so I think that that's where people often fight back and fight back for SB 54, et cetera. You had mentioned earlier, and Abe had mentioned this too, it's so important to public safety that law enforcement, local law enforcement and ICE aren't tangled up. And it's not just important for immigrants, but it's important to our entire community. Because if you are living in a home and your home gets robbed and the only witness is your neighbor and your neighbor is undocumented, they're not going to want to come forward and share what they witnessed and help you if they fear local law enforcement. And so it's really, really important to detangle these two different issues and think more about public safety for everyone and in general.
Yeah. Does local law enforcement, if I'm here without proper documentation and I get detained for anything, is local law enforcement required to let immigration know that they have detained someone who is not a legal resident in California?
No. So what usually happens is when an individual is detained, their fingerprints are taken, and they're run through all types of FBI databases, DHS databases, and ICE can find out that an individual is detained. But under what we call the California Sanctuary Policies, these group of SB 54, the Truth Act and the Trust Act, the local county jail is prohibited from notifying ICE of an individual's release date unless they're an exception to the law, and this includes many aggravated felonies. But what we see happening practically is that ICE will sometimes be waiting outside of the jails or will be actually go inside. I'll give you an example. One of our clients was charged with a misdemeanor and was placed at the Santa Barbara County Jail. His family bailed him out. He was handed his clothing outside of the... He was handed his clothing inside the county jail. He left the window, was instructed where to exit, opened the door, and was detained by ICE. He was sent to the Adelanto Detention Center in the high desert. His family did not have money to hire an immigration attorney. Luckily, they contacted us. We paired him with a pro bono attorney. He paid beyond the bail that he paid at the Santa Barbara County Jail. He paid an additional $5,000 bond to be released from immigrant detention and be able to come back to Santa Barbara County and be with his family. What we see happening practically and realistically, even after these laws have been put into place, is that the Sheriff's Department and ICE continue working together. And what many counties throughout California have done is that to get around this, we are not allowed to notify ICE. They have set up public databases where they list people's release dates, and they've found ways to kind of get around the law. And so that's what we're fighting for, to make sure that the heart of the law is followed so that people aren't ripped away from their families and sent to detention and deportation. Okay.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question because it's in the news so much right now. The Trump administration has been telling us all on most of the general media for a long time that there is this incredible reason to fear the caravan of Central American immigrants who are asylum seekers and other classifications that I will not say allegedly, that's a major threat to all of us. They've used some of that to imply that California is just making it worse by the laws we pass. Is this group of individuals that the Trump administration is referencing any different than any other group that's shown up at the border seeking either asylum or sanctuary or just immigrant status?
Well, I can say that asylum seekers have been coming to the U.S. for a very, very long time. The fact that they're coming in a caravan isn't something new. It's taken place in the past few years. The majority of these individuals are coming from Central America. So that's Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and Mexico as well. Many of them are seeking asylum, and they're doing it what people would call the right way. They're presenting themselves at a port of entry and requesting asylum. And a lot of people think, oh, these are like many immigrants, you know, they come here to work. A lot of these people are fleeing extreme violence in their home countries, whether it means beheadings, murders, domestic violence. We have clients who whose former partners are part of the local government and have beaten and raped them and in some cases set fire to their homes. These asylum seekers are coming to the U.S. not necessarily because they want to come here and work. But because they're fleeing extreme violence, and it's not easy to come to the U.S. and carry a child on your back and go through the desert. I think if given a choice, people maybe wouldn't be coming. But they're fleeing extreme violence, and people have been coming for some time. So it's not something new. And instead of thinking of these people as criminals, we should be thinking about them as refugees, which is what they are.
Do we think that is there any specific effort in California to try and counteract the extreme resistance of the Trump administration to these people?
I think that we've seen our state legislators do that, by passing these three laws that have been mentioned mm-hmm. today. I think it's, that's one of the reasons why California has been singled out a bit. And we're going to continue to fight for even more laws that are going to protect our immigrant communities. So I would say that, we are trying to fight that rhetoric because we've seen, by fact checking that a lot of what Trump is saying is simply not true, and that these immigrants are coming here peacefully. A lot of them, like Anaí mentioned, are actually turning themselves in on purpose because they want to seek that asylum status. Mm-hmm. And so the whole concept of them trying to come in and hurt us or anything like that is simply false.
Yeah. Anaí, the individuals who are seeking, who came in with the intent of seeking asylum, but came across the border illegally, is there a way with organizations like yours or other avenues for them to seek asylum once they're in the country, which translates into they may have come here illegally, but now to stay permanently, they'd like to get asylum? Or are they sort of singled out to, once you have an ask for asylum at the border, you've created a catch-22 for yourself?
No, absolutely not. So the way it works is an asylum seeker will come to the U.S. They don't always know about asylum, so maybe they cross the border without documents. If they are apprehended by Customs and Border Patrol within a certain mileage from the border, they're placed in deportation proceedings. They're usually sent somewhere called a hielera. In English, it translates to an icebox. And what it means is it's a giant concrete building with concrete floors, cold concrete floors, and fences. And they're held there with their children. They've often just crossed the border, and so they cross the river, and they're wet. Their clothing is wet. They're placed into these hieleras that are freezing cold, and they're held there for a few days, maybe a few hours, and then they're transferred to a place called the perrera, the dog pen, is what it translates to. And there, it's similar. They're held there for a few hours until they're sent to a detention center. Now, if they're coming with a child, they're sent to one of three family detention centers in the United States: the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas, the Carnes Detention Center in Carnes, Texas, or the Burke Family Detention Center in Pennsylvania. While they're held there, if they requested asylum, they are given a credible fear interview by the asylum office, where they have to show that they are likely to present a good claim for asylum. And so if they pass that credible fear interview, they're often released from detention. They're allowed to reunite with whatever family members they have in the U.S., if they have them, and they remain in deportation proceedings. So now they are in deportation proceedings at whichever court is closest to where they go live. If somebody comes to Santa Barbara County, that's the L.A. Immigration Court. And so they'll remain in deportation proceedings. They'll have check-ins with ICE, and they will try to find an attorney to represent them on their asylum case. So often people think of, you know, we need to send a lot of resources to the border. We need to help all the people that are coming at the border. And that's absolutely right. We should be helping people at the border. But the toughest part of your case is often once you're already in the U.S. and you have you're in deportation proceedings and you need to find an attorney. Asylum is usually won in all of these cities and not specifically at the border, because you're released from the border and allowed to come if you're able to show that you are eligible for asylum.
You brought up a very interesting point that I'm sorry we haven't addressed before this. Who sets the standard for what a credible fear is? Because there's been the impression that that's just a legal issue, but there's also been information that implies that administrative officials within the Justice Department and ICE get to, for lack of a better word, massage what that is. So I'm wondering how that's defined.
So maybe we'll start with the definition of asylum. If you're seeking asylum in the U.S., you have to show that you have a fear of returning to your country on account of one or more of five protected grounds. That may be your race, religion, political opinion, nationality, or membership in a particular social group. So the asylum office determines, well, first, international law and federal law says that people are allowed to seek asylum in the U.S. The asylum office is responsible for adjudicating credible fear interviews. An immigration judge decides under the Department of Justice, an Executive Office of Immigration Review decides whether an individual should be granted asylum. ICE does not decide whether someone should be granted asylum. ICE is merely responsible for executing whatever the judge decides. So if the judge decides an individual is going to be deported, that's when ICE would step in. What we've seen recently is former Attorney General Jeff Sessions decided that domestic violence victims were no longer would qualify under membership in a particular social group to receive asylum. And while this has been a huge setback for some domestic violence survivors, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't win their asylum cases anymore because they're eligible under other protected grounds. And so often people, you know, say that, you know, these asylum seekers are just lying about what happened to them in their home countries. I can tell you that it is extremely difficult to win in this crisis.
Yeah. By the way, you broke up a little bit. Can you give us the last part of it from, for some reason, I realize you're calling us on a cell phone. So can you say that again, please?
Oh, which part did you miss? Or where did I miss?
basically, the assumption that people come here and stating that they're applying for asylum when it's really not their circumstance.
Yeah, so a lot of people think that, you know, people are applying. And what I was saying is that it's extremely difficult, especially now. You have to present a lot of evidence. You have to provide a lot of testimony. There's witnesses. There's country conditions experts. There's psychological, psych evaluators, et cetera, et cetera. And the people that are coming, including many of the folks in that caravan, have valid asylum claims that the country has granted in the past. And so it's not just that they're coming and presenting fraudulent claims. People are fleeing something extremely horrific in their home countries.
Yeah. I want to go back. We only have a few more minutes. I want to go back to the number you came up with earlier. You talked about the 2,892 people who were detained in Santa Barbara County. Was that a 2017 figure, or it wasn't a year? It was not a year to date for this year, correct?
That number was from Syracuse University. has an ongoing FOIA with ICE, and they've determined that from November of 2017 through May of 2018, 2,892 people have been arrested in Santa Barbara County.
So that was only about a half a year.
That's correct.
Okay. How many of those people are still detained, and what is? Do you have any statistics on what the success ratio has been to deal with some of the concerns of these individuals?
That I wish I knew. So the FOIA doesn't cover everything. All we have are the number of people that have been arrested. We obviously don't get much information from ICE. We don't know if many of those people have been deported, et cetera, et cetera. What I can say anecdotally is because the Immigrant Legal Defense Center is new, that data hasn't really been collected for our region through other nonprofits. But what I'm seeing is that many people that are detained, sometimes families call us once the individual has a hearing the next day, and it's a final merits hearing where the judge decides whether they're going to be deported or not. We can't often help in those situations. So many people that are calling us because their family members have already been deported and they're trying to find them in their home country, or they're on the verge of being deported. Because we don't have nonprofit attorneys in this region, people often don't have access to someone to represent them, and that most always results in a deportation order.
Yeah. Abraham, when we're looking, I mean, Anahi's talking about their Immigration Legal Defense Center and what they're doing with cases that are actually like that. I suspect that you deal on a daily basis with a lot of population that luckily for them has not been detained, but lives in fear of being detained.
Yes.
How do those people look at the ability to make a living, get some income for their family? Mm-hmm. Technically, an employer is not supposed to hire someone who does not have legal status. But as we've seen and heard, there are readily available ways around that. So I suspect you're dealing with a lot of population that's just trying to avoid ever getting detained. But they fear of the ability to just get a job in some cases.
Yes. So one of the things that makes this whole situation tricky is that a lot of the families that are here in the Central Coast are mixed status families. So the children or a parent would be a citizen while another one would not. And so that makes it particularly tricky. And that's one of the reasons why we organize, is because, you know, as we've seen, for example, here in San Luis Obispo County, there was a big case of a mother who got, I believe last year, who got deported. And she was a mother to an underage citizen. And so that makes it even more tricky. But what we've seen from people that we work with is that many families, what they have to do is they have to have their children leave school or not able to, you know, attend school so that they can start working to help make ends meet, especially particularly if one of their breadwinners, if you will, parents are deported. And so we're seeing a case where a lot of that is happening, with particularly with the young people that we organize. We organize young people, young adults, and farm workers. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely the constant fear of that. The other thing is that we're worried about how this also translates into the workplace. So there's a lot of abuse. As we know, we're in a big region, a big farm working agricultural area. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fear about speaking up about workers' abuse, particularly because then you have also immigration tied into it. And so we're also trying to – that's one of the reasons why we're a multi-issue organization, is particularly because we know that a lot of these things tie together.
Yeah, good point. As my listeners know, I usually try and get out of the way for a few minutes so my guests can talk about the things that maybe we've forgotten and haven't hit on. And I guess there's also some things with regard to some public events going up. Abraham, why don't I start with you? What do you want to make sure that everybody knows and understands?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, you know, I know a lot of folks are very frustrated about what's happening at the border, but I would make sure to let people know that we can do a lot here as well. You know, there are families here that we need to protect as well. And so one of the things that we're going to be working on, and actually one of the things we're going to go ask the county to get us more information about those numbers that we've been talking about, to hopefully get some of those numbers. So that's definitely the intention that we're going in to those forums with. Mm-hmm. And so if a person particularly feels like they want to do something, you know, doing something on Facebook is good and all, but really showing up, especially particularly in these forums, is really, really important. So we ask you that, you know, if you live in San Luis Obispo County, the forum will be, you know, all of the forums will be on December 4th in San Luis Obispo County. It's going to be at 9 a.m. and it's going to be on 1055 Monterey Street at the County Government Center. In Santa Barbara County, there's going to be two in Santa Maria and in Santa Barbara at 3 p.m. same day at the County Government Centers. And then in Ventura County, same thing at 3:30 p.m. So we really ask you to turn out, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anahi, it's your turn.
Yeah, well, I hope everyone joins us at the forums taking place all throughout the Central Coast. The one thing that I wanted to share with everyone is that if they do know of someone who's been detained by ICE, please share our phone number with them. Our phone number is 805-886-9136. If you want to volunteer with us, we'd be more than happy to have you. We're an office of one staff member, just me. So we need interpreters, attorneys. If you can help driving people to court, that's also helpful. And then if you want to learn more about our organization, we're holding a holiday house party tomorrow, Friday, from 6 to 8. It's going to be at 3061 Calle Noguera in Santa Barbara. We're asking for a $25 donation, and we're going to have wine and hors d'oeuvres, and it's going to be a fun evening. And then finally, on December 7th, we're having a live benefit auction at the Live Oak Cafe in Santa Barbara, and we hope that you all can join us. We'll have appetizers, wine, and a few auction items, including vacation stays in Tuscany and a lake house in British Columbia. So please join us, help how you can, and thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Regardless of county, I would say to go to 805immigrant.org. 805immigrant.org.
805immigrant.org is an organization. Okay. So you probably also, if you don't have that exactly, you can Google it, and that will probably get you
for any county
connection you want. I want to thank my guest today, and thank you all for joining us on Central Coast Voices. This is a topic that's not going to go away. It's a topic we need to address. We're in an interesting situation that the state of California and the federal government don't agree on this. So personally, I'm glad I'm in California. But I'm glad we've had this topic on for you today. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be with you, and all the details of her show have not been finalized yet, so she'll be with you. And we'll follow those up, watch the updates from KCBX. And as I've told you before, Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation, along with KCBX. You can see our report called Vital Signs. You can go to actionslo.org and see some information about the state of San Luis Obispo County. A new report will be coming out in 2019. It comes out every 3 years. If you want to contribute any kind of information or suggestions for programming, or feedback, you can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or 805-543-2323. Thank you to Joan Gellert Sargent for her ongoing underwriting and support, and to KCBX for allowing us to have this program with you every week. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you again to my guests, Abraham Melendres and Anahi Mendoza. We've had a wonderful time talking about a topic that I have to say is not wonderful for a lot of people. So whatever we can do to make it better for anybody, I believe we're all in this together. And thank you for listening to Central Coast Voices.
Thank you.